WBEZ's Nonprofit Spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org. This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Division of the Arts and Humanities at the University of Chicago, offering an interdisciplinary Master of Arts program in Humanities that provides individualized attention in a supporting community. The flexible curriculum allows students to focus coursework within a single department or engage with multiple disciplines, creating a uniquely tailored graduate degree. Applications now open for the April 30th deadline at humanities.uchicago.edu.
Hey, Chicago, I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is In the Loop. Stick around to get updates on the latest stories happening right here in Chicago. But first, Chicago's got a long tradition of old buildings finding new purpose. And there's a great example of this in Woodlawn, just steps from Washington Park. The building dates back to 1923, and over the years has been many things, including a synagogue. And now, something kind of unexpected. A local couple has turned it into an arts club. We'll get a tour of the transformation. At the table was Dennis Rodkin, who's In the Loop's architecture guru, and Amber Ginsberg, who's an artist, teacher, and civic director of the Narrow Bridge Arts Club. Now, I had Dennis start us off with a look back at 2020. That's when the Ginsbergs bought the building. It was a Christian church at the time, so I had to know more. Here's Dennis.
At the time, it was the Cosmopolitan Community Church. It was owned by a different, the previous resident, which was Freedom Temple Church of God in Christ. Mm-hmm. It had been a Christian church, a series of congregations for about seven decades, needed a lot of work, but also had a lot of original details, either still visible or at least still there, if not visible.
Yeah.
And that's when Amber and Tom Ginsberg, who are Hyde Park people, he teaches at the law school and she teaches art, bought this and brought it back. It might have been demolished had they not.
Yeah, and then before we get you to weigh in here, I know you visited, Dennis, the part single-family home, part makerspace. Tell us, just give us an overview of just the overall flow of the interior, because I'm my mind is racing here.
Yeah, it's really remarkable. Work? Well, when you come up to this three-story building, you have no idea what it is like inside. First floor, which is kind of a raised basement, really the ground floor, is this arts club and makerspace. Mm-hmm. Come up and you're on a landing that is the Ginsbergs' living room. It would have been the landing that the congregation would have come up on their way into the sanctuary. That's their living room. Move on into what was the sanctuary and you've got the rest of their two-bedroom apartment. And then beyond that, you go out onto the sanctuary floor, which is this giant space, two stories high. And then there's a third floor, which is a loft overlooking that sanctuary floor. That would have been the women's loft when this was a synagogue that was sex segregated back in the 1920s. And that's where they have their offices. So that big sanctuary floor is really the cornerstone, the main piece
of
it.
It's doing all the work.
Yeah, it's part of their living space, and it is also available to the arts club members. And it's a really remarkable room.
Yeah, this sounds like a dream space, Amber. Why this building? What intrigued you about this building on South Champlain?
Well, as an artist, I participate in a history of art called social sculpture. And so I really think of this as like the largest sculpture to date. Mm. And social sculpture thinks about place and people and materials all together. So as an artist, I'd been commuting to East Garfield Park, where, you know, former factories are now art spaces. Mm-hmm. And I had been listening for a decade and a half that access is uneven. and there aren't studios on the South Side.
Right. So what does it mean to have this space on the South Side?
So this space is now transformed from what has always been a community space. It has always been a place of gathering and worship and celebration.
Right.
And now we are rethinking studios and art making. We have taken down all the walls, and there aren't private studios, which when you look at architectural plans for 4 years, as I did, it's amazing the ways in which art studios mimic prison cells. There's generally a central hallway with rectangles off of them. And as I was thinking about how to share this space, questions of access are always on my mind.
Right.
And with no walls, we have open studios, fiber art studios, woodshop, mark making, and many more people can then share the space. So why now is this building was going to be demolished? And then why, what now is thinking about adaptation and collective sharing?
Speaking of adaptation, I mean, you and your husband, Tom, you were intentional about a lot of things, but also preserving as much of the old materials as possible, right?
Yes.
Even as you were changing the layout. And so as an artist, why was that approach, that, you know, reusing materials approach important?
Thanks. That's such a great question, Sasha. I really appreciate it. I have come to think about buildings not in terms of their life and use, the way that like a LEED certification might, but the birth, life, and death of buildings. Mm. So again, as an artist, I think so much about material. And so we did two budgets. I worked with architect Charlie Vins from Adaptive Operations, and we had the monetary budget and the loan and all of those things.
Mm-hmm.
We also did an embodied carbon study. So we calculated the brick, the steel, the glass, the wood.
Oh, wow.
And found out what did we inherit? What is it that we have already? So that then includes the birth of the building. Thinking about deaths of buildings, when you demolish a building, it turns into mixed rubble, which can be quite toxic. And I'll just talk for a second about the wood in the building.
Sure.
In 1892, there was enough lumber harvested to create a 300-foot boardwalk around the equator of the earth. So you could think about buildings as you walk. All the ones, Chicago had this huge post-fire building.
Mm-hmm.
You could look at every building on my block and in the city and think of that as the Northwoods Forest. So what if we really took seriously that material and did not throw it away, but reused it? So for this whole 14,000 square foot building project, we had six dumpsters. And mostly one bathroom is a dumpster, right?
Right.
So every single material stayed on site.
That's amazing.
And got re-metabolized back into the design.
And you described it also beautifully in your story there, Dennis. I mean, you talk about how the copper from the rooftop is now kitchen and bath countertops. What else can you share? There was wood flooring being reused as well.
Well, those countertops really are the thing that talks to you about the life of the building, because
amazing.
I
want to see this.
Oh, you should go. There were two copper domes on essentially the shoulders of the building. They had been coated in tar. They needed to be brought down. They were leaking. And Amber actually refabricated the copper into countertops all through the kitchen, the two bathrooms. It's really remarkable to see. There is wood from the flooring that is on closet doors now in sort of a decorative style.
Right. And benches too, right?
Benches. There are so many things that are made out of the existing materials. Her idea was nothing leaves this site except for insulation and other things that would be toxic. And so some things are piled waiting for another life. The stained glass windows, the sanctuary has these rows of tall tablet-shaped windows. It looks like, you know, they're in Paris. They look like the tablets the Ten Commandments are on. the stained glass all had to come out for several reasons. One, it needs restoration. Mm-hmm. And another, they were building the walls out further to fill in with insulation. And all that stained glass is waiting in the building to be restored and reused, perhaps in Southside churches. There's just so much that has been reused. Even the Cosmopolitan Church sign, which used to hang on the front, is in a stairwell as, you know, a fun old sign.
And like we said, I mean, there's so much rich history here. We're going back to 1923 when it was first built. It was originally a synagogue, right?
B'nai Bezalel, a congregation that had been around for several years, built this in 1923. Mm-hmm. They were there until 1942.
And then it became just a series of different Christian churches.
For about 70 years, until 2019. And then this family bought it in 2020.
And something interesting you said to me, Amber, when we spoke, you said that this project was a life twist.
Yes.
It's like you didn't expect that this wasn't in your on your bingo card.
No, I did not see myself as a civic director of a, you know, arts organization, more as, you know, an artist and a teacher. But one thing that this building has taught me is, you know, I'm going to answer this sort of across these two questions. This question of preservation or adaptation is also like how your life unfolds. So this was a carbon neutral design. And part of the thing that I kept thinking about with these materials was, can this be a model? So in this carbon bank, in this carbon analysis, we created an imaginary, a speculative carbon bank.
Oh. And tell us more about how that works.
So we did this remodel using less carbon than already existed in the building. So carbon banking is a global thing that people are thinking about. So we did a carbon neutral remodel. We have high insulation, geothermal. There's solar panels are coming on in the spring, so we will be a energy contributor on the block. So
you've also said that it could serve as a model for Chicago's overall carbon neutral future.
Exactly. So what if we thought of this city as a carbon bank? If we did that, and we could use that inherited material capital towards carbon neutral transformations, this entire city could be carbon neutral in 5 years. Mm. So when you start thinking both about like what you are participating in globally and locally, then that began to get me thinking about how to use materials in the space.
Right.
So we have huge amounts of donated materials and upcycled materials, and we're working towards being zero waste. We're not there yet, but we're working towards it.
On the way. Yeah.
On the way. And all this kind of thinking along the building made me realize that it was exciting to extend these ideas through the living future practice of the building. And once the walls came down and once we became, you know, a volunteer organization,
yes,
a collective organization, I became involved in a different way and find myself in this life twist.
Amazing.
As a civic director.
and as you point out, Dennis, I mean, this is an ongoing transformation, right? It's amazing to think of all the work that's been done. It's been open since 2023. There's still more.
There's a lot more. There are just,
you talked about
as
the
an
solar
example,
panels.
Yeah, the solar panels are coming. And up in that loft I mentioned, Amber has piled all the old light fixtures that used to hang from the ceiling, and she's planning to sculpt that into something new.
Oh my goodness.
That she calls a Franken fixture that would hang from the ceiling in a more decorative way than being a light. And it just goes on. The garden has projects coming. There are rain barrels collecting water from the roof. It's really a pretty remarkable project.
And does it feel like home, Amber? Because it's also home, right?
Yes.
Living there, is that pretty cool? Because it sounds like it.
It is. You know, we are learning what it's like to live in both a private and shared semi-public space.
Yes.
And that is true with humans, and it's also true with light.
Yeah.
It's like living in a forest. The windows are so big that sometimes I'll be standing there and I'm like, I feel sad. Wait, what's going on? Oh, right, clouds are going by and all the shadows and the light has changed.
You can see everything.
I can see everything.
That's incredible.
And a lot of that has to do with Charlie Vinz's designs. You know, this is a project that wasn't done alone. Mm-hmm. And he has a architecture firm called Adaptive Operations. And I think there's something quite different thinking culturally between preservation, which is to hold something firm, and adaptation.
WBEZ's nonprofit spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org. This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Division of the Arts and Humanities at the University of Chicago, offering an interdisciplinary Master of Arts program in Humanities that provides individualized attention in a supporting community. The flexible curriculum allows students to focus coursework within a single department or engage with multiple disciplines, creating a uniquely tailored graduate degree. Applications now open for the April 30th deadline at humanities.uchicago.edu.
Okay, now it's time to get into the top local stories of the day. At the table to help me break them down was Claire Lane, WBEZ Morning Edition anchor, Mitchell Armantrout, Chicago Sun-Times government and politics reporter, and Summer Van Benton, WBEZ reporter. We kick things off with a story from D.C. Well, Mayor Johnson was there for a conference of U.S. mayors. Here's Mitch with details.
So this was a chance for Brandon Johnson to call for what he says is bold progressive action to take on, basically responding to the federal immigration enforcement that we've seen in Chicago and more recently in Minneapolis. He says that his administration is contemplating basically new ways to take it on, up to and including prosecution. Mm-hmm. You know, as with a lot of other parts of his progressive agenda, not really heavy on specifics as to what that'll look like, but he's kind of comparing this to a new civil rights movement is basically the approach that the city and nation should take.
Absolutely. Yeah. And he's no fan, as we've seen over the last several months, of any of this aggressive immigration enforcement. He doubled down at the National Press Club yesterday, saying that he aims to make Chicago basically the nation's first city to do this, right, to hold ICE and Border Patrol agents accountable. Let's hear more from him.
Chicagoans are asking us to do more in this moment. And it is certainly our aim to meet their expectations. We are working on additional measures that we believe will make Chicago the first city in the country to be able to effectively hold ICE and Border Patrol officers accountable for criminal misconduct. This is not about politics. This is about a more fundamental idea that in our country, nobody is above the law. There is no such thing as absolute immunity in America. If you commit a crime, you should be tried like anyone else.
Claire, what do you make of those comments?
You know, I think this reminds us a lot of what Johnson has said in the past, which is, we'll see you in court. You know, that's something that he has been pretty adamant about. And these statements fall in line with a lot of what elected officials here in Illinois have been saying, especially in recent days in the wake of the two killings in Minneapolis. As we know, Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker continuing to call for the impeachment of U.S. Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem and for a total overhaul of the U.S. Department of Homeland Security.
Yeah.
Illinois Senator Tammy Duckworth standing with other House Democrats who are intensifying their opposition to funding the Department of Homeland Security without some serious guardrails for ICE. So Johnson here, you know, offering his version of a solution, I think, that will mirror other Democrats, especially in states that have dealt hands-on, as we have, with federal immigration enforcement in their cities, Portland, Nashville, L.A.
Yeah, and you said it earlier, Mitch. I mean, he's calling for a civil rights movement type of approach. He even criticized, you know, quote, tepid actions from Democrats.
Right. I think he's kind of frustrated, not only just with the rhetoric that we've seen from a lot of national party leaders, but also, yeah, just like the lack of a unified effort in one direction or the other. Again, what does that look like at the city level? What can the city do? I mean, there aren't city prosecutors, but, you know, he's kind of talked broadly about pushing corporations to kind of join the effort as well. Is he pushing like a movement like we've seen at the state level with the Illinois Accountability Commission, and a similar transparency effort being pushed by former Mayor Lori Lightfoot? It'll depend on what specific proposal he puts forward.
Well, U.S. Senator Tammy Duckworth was on Morning Edition this morning, just a few hours ago. She is calling for new rules on the use of force by Department of Homeland Security agents. You can tell she's frustrated listening to that interview. Let's hear some.
Over 100 days ago, I sent their inspector general a request saying, let's form a task force. Let's form a task force with both local police, but also justice and DHS investigators that are independent of ICE to do to look into the violence involving ICE agents. And remember, this is after what they did in Chicago, which is when I put in the request, and they denied my request. And then within the language of the budget bill for ICE that came out of the House, they inserted language that says there will be no independent investigation of ICE. And that, for me, was the last straw.
What else is she calling for, Mitch?
So the crux of what she's calling for is limiting the jurisdiction of Border Patrol, which, you know, before this second Trump administration, mostly we would hear about Border Patrol enforcement at the southern border, Texas, right. Arizona, you know, in the south. But the Trump administration really pushed that to within 100 miles of the air miles of any border, which obviously folks in Chicago, officials in Chicago have said that's not a great thing. So what Senator Duckworth is trying to do is to, one, she thinks that Lake Michigan should not be considered a border, which is one way the Trump administration has kind of justified the huge force that they've shown here.
Right.
And also wants to limit that kind of radius from 100 air miles to 1 mile of the border. So really trying to rein in just the way where these officers can enforce the law. And she
get
also
some
wants
guardrails on.
Exactly. Yeah. And she wants to limit the use of force by ICE and Border Patrol through these roving patrols that we saw even marching through downtown Chicago last fall. That was kind of one of the first big publicity stunts from Greg Bovino.
That's right.
Really just kind of looking at any way to limit the scope of their enforcement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let's bring you in here, Summer, because I remember you talked with Duckworth last month about this topic. I mean, what was that conversation like? What were your takeaways?
Yeah, so in mid-December, the U.S. Senate Armed Services Committee had a hearing with the Trump administration to underscore the cost on, you know, residents across the nation, but also to get the Trump administration on record, underscoring and understanding what their intended mission was. What was the intended mission of these federal agents? And there was a lot left unsaid from the Trump administration. And so now that we're here, it's January, and we have the congressional budget back, and we're seeing that, you know, back in December, the estimated impact was about $341 million. And now we're seeing that it's actually nearly $500 million. Those numbers are jarring. And learning that the impact on Illinois itself, especially considering all the issues that Illinoisans are facing on the day-to-day basis, understanding that that impact is $21 million, it raises some flags.
Yeah. Well, the Senate is expected to vote today on whether to fund the government. The deadline is tomorrow, and many Democrats like Duckworth are saying that they're not going to vote for the spending plan if it includes funding for ICE, and that at this point, I mean, you know, she's not confident that we can avoid another government shutdown. So that'll be interesting to watch. Speaking of Duckworth, this was another story in this morning's Sun Times. Vice President J.D. Vance, he came after her with comments that critics have been calling ableist. Now, many people know that Duckworth uses a wheelchair. This is after losing her legs while serving in Iraq.
Claire, what happened?
Yeah, she is a disabled veteran, and the vice president of our country posted on social media, this was after a pretty tense exchange, arguing this funding for the Department of Homeland Security between Duckworth and Secretary of State Marco Rubio during a Senate Foreign Relations Committee meeting yesterday. The vice president posted that watching the dispute was, quote, like watching Forrest Gump, who he's comparing to Duckworth, argue with Isaac Newton. Jeez. Who he is comparing to Marco Rubio. So immediately, Governor J.B. Pritzker coming to the defense of Duckworth. Duckworth also calling the comment petty at the expense of people with disabilities. So more name-calling and more bullying.
Now, Mitch, as Chicago City Council member, he's throwing his name in the hat for a congressional bid.
Alderman Byron Sigcho-Lopez, a progressive firebrand from the Pilsen 25th Ward. He's running for the seat that Congressman Chuy Garcia will be giving up next year. That was obviously a controversial process that we've talked a lot about over the last couple months. Chuy opted at the last second, essentially, announced at the last second that he wouldn't be running for another term. That district kind of stretches out to the southwestern suburbs. And his announcement left basically only time for one person to file for that race, and that is his chief of staff, Patty Garcia, no relation.
That's right.
So Byron Sigcho-Lopez was among a lot of Democrats. You know, this was condemned even on the House floor in Washington, just kind of as an example of old school Chicago politics, kind of paving the way for the anointed successor. You know, Chuy said that it was a family decision based on health issues that he's had. But yeah, so this is basically Byron Sigcho-Lopez will be running as an independent. There's also another independent who's announced for the race. That's Myra Macias, who's a community organizer, formerly worked under, was a field organizer for Barack Obama. Another person who really has criticized the way Chuy went about this. So at least three people will be vying for that seat now.
Interesting. Let's switch gears, Summer, and talk about this national blood shortage. What's going on?
So, yes, there is a national blood shortage. The American Red Cross is warning that the severe blood shortage is across the Illinois region. It says that they've seen a 35% decrease in blood supply in the last month, and part is due to the severe winter weather. The Sun-Times reports that local healthcare specialists are urging people to get out and donate. Which you can do at one of the seven donation centers in the Chicago area.
Just what is it the cold doing?
The domino effect of this extreme weather. My goodness, Summer.
Well, it's postponing construction projects, too, on the northwest side. We had some news this morning. I mean, it's blame the cold, truly, because you can at this point.
Goodness. Well, what other news are you watching out for, Claire?
Well, it's keeping sports at top of mind. We no longer have the Bears to talk about, but this is kind of interesting, especially for those who like women's sports. Chicago's Lakeview neighborhood going to be the new home of a new bar dedicated to the watching and the fanship of women's sports.
Oh, yes.
This is the brainchild of a former Northwestern University basketball player, Clarissa Flores, as she teamed up with six other female investors to launch Level Sporting Club. It'll be near Wrigley Field. And Level Sporting Club is joining a few other bars we've seen pop up, showcasing women's sports. Babes in Logan Square that just opened in 2025, and a longstanding Edgewater Whiskey Tavern Girl. So this is supposed to open in Wrigleyville in end of April.
Awesome. Yeah, we've had the folks from Whiskey Tavern Girl, and we've talked about that movement of just there's a wave happening, and not just in Chicago, but elsewhere. Folks are getting on the bandwagon and opening up women's sports bars. So I love to see it. The millennials would love to see this summer. There's a Y2K-inspired festival coming to our city. What's going on?
Yeah, the music gods have definitely heard my prayers. I'm extremely excited about the Forever Mine Festival that was announced just yesterday. You can't keep me away from K-Tronada, Keisha Cole, Kelly Rowland, Monica Lloyd, and some of my favorite DJs. Some of my favorite Chicago DJs are spinning as well. You have Such and Such, Hillary Banks, Indulgence, Ace Spade, to name a few. This summer is going to be hot. You know, a lot of people are comparing 2026 to 2016, and I'm definitely feeling that energy.
Yeah, I've been following that trend and posting my 2016 highlights. Yes, my throwbacks. So you named a lot of folks there. I mean, does anyone have a favorite artist from that era? Can you pick one?
No.
It's so hard to choose.
Can you pick just one? It is hard to choose.
I'm thinking Backstreet Boys. I mean, that's when I think of Y2K. Backstreet Boys, yeah. NSYNC.
I mean, listen, right before coming on air, I was blasting a Christina Aguilera song.
Yeah. There you go.
I mean, you know, we got a lot of folks to look forward to. So, and I'll be talking with one of the performers from Forever Mine later this hour. So we'll play some tunes as well here on In the Loop. Speaking of festivals and fun things to do, though, around town, the Taste of Chicago is returning to July. It's going back to its rightful place. Are folks going to miss NASCAR, you think? Or are they going to be like, yes, the Taste is back to its regular schedule?
I don't think there's going to be that many tears shed. I think, you know, it'll be nice kind of to have Grant Park open for another weekend. It seems like the last couple summers, the whole place has been shut down for like 2 or 3 months at a time with all the festivals coming through. So, yeah, having the Taste back, that really feels like a July activity to me.
It does.
Just like burning in the sun. Not quite as bad in August. You know?
Yeah. What do you think, Summer?
Yeah, I covered NASCAR street race last year, and race car lovers are definitely going to miss the street race, but I think the Chicagoans I spoke to are going to be excited about not having to reroute in the morning or...
Yeah, that was a pain.
You know, the loud engines downtown. So, you know, the Taste of Chicago is a beloved staple. People are always excited about that one. NASCAR, they might be okay with
Bye,
this.
Bye, NASCAR. WEZ's Claire Lane and Summer Van Benton and Mitchell Armantrout from the Sun-Times. This episode of In the Loop was produced by me, Sasha Ann Simons, and edited by Ethan Schwab. For more in-depth coverage of news and culture in Chicago, be sure to subscribe to this podcast. For a full archive of the show, just head to wbez.org/in the loop. Thanks for listening.